In this second hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about life inside the antebellum slave market. Our guest for this program is historian Walter Johnson. He's professor of history and American studies at New York University and has authored a book examining the subject. The title of his book is Soul by Soul. It's now available in the paperback edition published by the Harvard University Press and has won a number of prizes, including the John Hope Franklin Prize of the American Studies Association, as well as the Book Prize for 2000 of the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic. Our guest, Walter Johnson, joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, you certainly should feel free to call in if you have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be long-distance call, use that number, and the call will be on us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, locally, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Johnson, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
As one looks at the map, if you were looking for places that you would think would have been significant in slave trade, a number of places suggest themselves: port cities on the coast, Charleston, Savannah, Mobile, and indeed these were important markets, but none was bigger. New Orleans apparently was North America's biggest slave market in this time before the Civil War. What was it about New Orleans that that made it so?
Well, New Orleans is really ideal. It's in an ideal geographic position as far as the 19th century economy goes. In the 19th century, the economy is really an economy that's based on water transport. It's difficult to get goods to market otherwise. And so New Orleans sits at the juncture of the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico, or you could say at the juncture of the Mississippi River Valley economy and the Atlantic economy. And so for exporting all of the cotton that's produced out there in what becomes called the Cotton Kingdom out of New Orleans to places like Liverpool, and importing all of the finished goods, manufactured goods, upon which slaveholders like all other well-to-do Americans rely, New Orleans is in an ideal position. And that's no different as far as the slave trade goes. That a lot of the business in the slave trade is shipboard business. It's people who are being shipped from places like those you mentioned on the eastern seaboard and some a little bit further north, like Baltimore or Norfolk in particular. And people are being shipped down the Mississippi River. Mm. There's also an overland trade, which is people who walk across from a place like North Carolina out to a place like Alabama, say.
Hmm. That certainly slaves and slavery was very important to the economy of the South in this period. Was the slave trade, when we talk specifically about the economy either of New Orleans or the state of Louisiana, how important was it for that city and for that region?
It's hugely important. You can think about its importance. You could measure its importance in a number of ways. One way to think about it would be to think about the fact that it's largely through the slave trade that the economy of slavery moves to the Southwest. That's to say that when the land in places like Virginia, where there's been a lot of tobacco production, starts to run out, people start to sell slaves as well as migrate themselves to places like Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. That, over the course of the period between 1820 and 1860, accounts for the movement of about 1 million slaves, that southwestern trend within slavery. And two-thirds of those people, the most recent work suggests, were shipped through the domestic slave trade. So as far as the macro-historical economics of slavery, it's very important. Another way to think about it would be to think about the role that slaves play in the daily business of slavery. And one historian who works in Louisiana has estimated that 80% of collateralized transactions use slave collateral. So that they use slaves function as the mortgaged collateral. The preference for slaves over land in those transactions clearly depends upon their comparative liquidity, on the ability of slaveholders to sell them. And so in that sense, the slave trade is crucial to almost all of the transactions that are done in the antebellum South.
Mm-hmm. There was a ban on importation of slaves in 1808. So at that point, no new slaves came into the country.
Right.
So after that, any slaves that were sold within the United States were sold from one owner, from one owner to another.
Right.
And this was something that one of the realities for that all slaves had to live with was the possibility that their owners would sell them. And indeed, the owners used that as a threat.
That's right.
To try to control them. What would be some of the reasons that that an owner would sell their slaves?
Well, slaveholders come up with any number of reasons for selling slaves, and they are mostly reasons which try to shift the blame away from the slave trader or from the slave seller as a sort of conscience agent responsible for their own actions, which is to say they argue that these things are necessary, that there is no other way that they can get out of debt, or that they blame the slaves themselves. They say that the slaves have not worked hard enough or that they've behaved badly, that sometimes people get sold because women get sold because younger men in the white household are after them, and the white young white men's parents don't want that sort of relationship to occur. There's any number of reasons. The way that this ramifies for slaves is that they are, as you suggested, they're constantly under the threat of sale, and that fear of sale infuses, I argue in the book, many of their family relations, their community relations, all of the things which make slavery survivable, all of the relationships have within them the threat of their own dissolution. They have within them the possibility that they could be separated at any moment.
Mm. Well, when slaves discovered that or learned that there was this possibility that they would be sold, what did they do?
Well, some run away. There is apparent in slave narratives, particularly a fantastic collection of narratives now out of print, but called A North Side View of Slavery, which are interviews with slaves who've escaped to Canada, interviews in the free black communities in Ontario, is done in the 1840s, make clear that slaves often have pretty good knowledge of the coming moment of sale. Slaves have, slaveholders talk very freely about their business as if slaves don't listen in. And so there's an underground network of information that people can use to get information. And so sometimes they run away. Running away is, of course, difficult if you have a family or if you have children. And sometimes they argue with their owners and they say, you know, that you promised me you wouldn't sell me, or you promised me that you wouldn't divide my marriage, or I've served you well. And occasionally those arguments are successful. By and large, I mean, if you look at those statistics, 250,000 of those arguments are not successful. And so it's one of the many ways, I think, that enslaved people's efforts to shape their own lives shapes the history that they're involved in. They are often on the losing end of those struggles.
Mm-hmm. Some apparently committed suicide rather than be sold.
That's absolutely right. There's a series of very startling images that come out of some of the narratives of people who would rather die than go to Louisiana. Louisiana is, as the narrator, the slave narrativist Jacob Stroyer said, is thought of as a place of death by the slaves. And so, in some sense, it's a choice between death and death.
Hmm. And is that this about more than just the fact that they're being sold would break off family connections, would take them away from the life that they had known? It also meant going into a different life. Chances are, in some cases, maybe becoming field hands, doing work that they hadn't done before. A much less desirable situation.
I think that's right, and I think the situation in Louisiana is, as far as slavery goes, quite a bit less desirable. Many of the slaves in Louisiana are put to work cultivating sugar, and southeastern Louisiana is the only place in the United States where sugar is cultivated at all. And sugar, as one historian has argued, is made with blood. That sugar cultivation is enormously brutal. That the harvest time is in the hottest months of the year, and in order to get the sugar out of the fields before its sweetness is exhausted, before its sweetness seeps out into the ground, enslaved people were put to work in the heat for 16 hours a day. So really doing work that was beyond the capacity of any human being. And so the mortality is tremendous. And so there's that literal death, along with what I call the social death that you spoke about the extraction from all of those networks of family and community that make life meaningful. Mm.
As you mentioned and as you discuss in the book, important sources for this book and this kind of work are slave narratives, are all of the records that were left by slave traders. There are many letters and other kinds of writings by people who own slaves that mention the slaves and the relations that they had with them and how they felt about it and so forth. How, generally speaking, if you can say this, did slave owners think about what it was they were doing and how conscious of they were the fact that here they were owning and using as a tool, sometimes almost the way you would use an animal, another human being?
A lot of people have tried to argue that there's a contradiction there, that there's a philosophical contradiction that slaveholders were unable to resolve. And I think I take a bit dimmer view of it than that, because I think that slaveholders are always intensely aware of the humanity and feelings of their slaves. And I think that's already sort of been an apparent in some of the examples you gave, is that slaveholders use the threat of sale to discipline slaves. They say, I will sell you if you don't do what I want you to do. Well, what they're doing then is that they are insinuating themselves into the slave's human connections. They are making those connections their own. Another way to think about this would just to think about the physical parameters of the trade. Physical parameters of the trade involve high walls, they involve chains, and they involve whips. And that means that there is, in the daily practice of the trade, there's a recognition of the unwillingness of the enslaved people to participate in this. And so you could turn that around and you could say that it's actually the unwillingness of the enslaved people to participate in this that makes visible the coercion, that makes it necessary for slave traders to do this in such a obscene fashion. And that's something that later on, I argue, 19th century abolitionists are able to seize on. So in that sense, the humanity of this through evoking, insisting upon their own humanity, enslaved people are able to create information that becomes very useful to both black and white abolitionists in the North as they try to fight against slavery.
I should introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Walter Johnson. He is Associate Professor of History and American Studies at New York University. His book is titled Soul by Soul, Life Inside the Antebellum Slave Market, and it's published by the Harvard University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Supposing that one was a slave owner, and for whatever reason, you had debts that had to be settled, things weren't going well in your life, you had to sell a slave. How would one go about doing this?
Well, there is, in addition to this large interstate slave trade that we've been talking about, the two-thirds of a million, there are millions of more local sales, and that would be somebody in a neighborhood of New Orleans, selling an enslaved person to somebody else in a neighborhood of New Orleans. And there are about 1 1/3 million of those that occur over the period of the antebellum South. Now, a lot of that, I argue in the book, occurs through brokers. And so what somebody in an urban area wishing to do that would do is go take the enslaved person to the slave dealer and put them there on a consignment basis, so that they would get the price when the slave dealer sold the slave. The slave dealer would get, in that case, room and board and a 2.5% commission. Slave traders, interstate slave traders, travel throughout the Upper South during the summer months, buying slaves in order to ship them south in the fall. So they go from small town to small town, just trying to drum up business. And then alongside those two sort of models, there's a set of models that are very informal, just one person talking to their neighbors, talking in saloons, talking at hotels, and you know, finding a way to sell their slaves that way. Now, the final thing, since you were talking about debt, that can happen is that there are state-ordered slave sales. When people get into debt, their property is often auctioned off by the state, and slaves are first and foremost among that property that gets auctioned off.
Yeah, and I'm sure there also were estate sales a person dies, their property is sold, and here slaves would be considered to be a piece of property like anything else.
Absolutely right. And that takes us back again to how integral the fact of the slave trade is to the daily life of the antebellum South, is that you can't settle a state without valuing the slaves. The idea that a human being has a cash value, has a price attached to them, is an idea that depends upon the slave market.
Mm-hmm. We have several callers to bring into the conversation, so let's do that. We'll take them in the order they came in. First caller is in Belgium, and that number, that line is line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. You haven't approached this part of the topic. Maybe that's not part of your discussion, but when the initial enslaved people came from Africa, these people, the slavers, the people who owned the ships, didn't just go out and grab them off the shore. You know, surely there was some participation with other tribes or...
No, right. My work is about the interstate slave trade, and so it's actually about the period in American history after the Atlantic slave trade is closed.
I see.
Now, but there's no question that there is, that societies in Africa in the pre-colonial period are like societies in the rest of the world. They are class societies. And that there are people who are from the continent of Africa, often from different areas on the continent of Africa, who are involved in the merchant slave trade. A lot of times when I tell, and particularly audiences of white students about this, that there's this sense of relief, like, okay, well, Atlantic slave trade is not our fault. And I think that that's not the the message of that piece of history. The message of that piece of history is that there is... an articulation between two sets of two different really relationships of slavery that occurs through class domination, and so it's a part of the way in which slavery is a world history that involves Europeans and Africans.
Yeah, because there was a slave trade that goes way back to biblical times, essentially in Africa, wasn't there?
Well, there is. You know, I think that there's a whole set of very complicated distinctions that we would want to make about the character of African slavery in relationship to the character of slavery in the Americas. In many cases, slavery in Africa is it's a system of political domination rather than economic exploitation, which is to say it's a way of structuring a society. And slaves in Africa can become generals in armies, can become placeholders for rulers, although, you know, many of the rest of them are doing agricultural production. So it's a different sort of system, but absolutely it's an ancient system. And the other thing that I would want to add to that is that there is a there's a slave trade out of Eastern Africa, which is 10 to 12 million people, so it's a little bit smaller but comparable to the Atlantic slave trade out of Western Africa, that together those two phenomena mean that there's basically zero population growth on the continent of Africa between 1750 and 1850. So it's a tremendous depredation.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk next with a caller in Champaign on line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, Mike. It's a comment and question. During the slave revolution in Haiti, in the late 1700s, there was clearly a number of slaveholders and maybe even free people of color who moved from Haiti to Louisiana. Do you know much about that history?
It's not something that I know a good deal about through direct research. Now, that is part of, it's a sort of an infusion of both French culture and African culture. into Louisiana, and it's one of the things that makes slavery in Louisiana different from slavery elsewhere in North America. It's one of the reasons that you have vodun or voodoo.
Yes.
In Louisiana, to an extent that you don't have in much of the rest of the South. And,
do you have any sense of the numbers of that transfer?
Well, I would. It's certainly in the thousands. As far as between 5,000 and 500,000, I'm not certain, to be honest.
And most of those numbers were they free people or slaves?
Well, a lot of it is in the first instance is slaveholders seeking to hold on to their slave property by bringing their slaves to Louisiana. Then, as the revolution in Haiti unfolds, and different groups and are on top at different times, and different alliances are made, I think that presumably there's a spectrum of people, which is to say, freed former slaves, those who in Haiti were gens de couleur, free people of color, and those who were white slaveholders or white, non-slaveholding whites. So I think all of those people come at one time or another. If it's not something that I've done a good deal of work on myself, and so I don't think I could give you a detailed answer of how many of each group comes when.
Okay, having lived in New Orleans for a while,
yeah.
I read that the population in and around New Orleans may have doubled in size over a 20-year period, possibly due to that the transfer of
mm-hmm.
people.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
That wouldn't.
No, it's, you know, then we're probably talking 20, 40,000 people, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Okay.
And I think that there is, it's not something that is in your standard history book, but there's
no.
A big slave revolt in St. John the Baptist Parish, Louisiana, which is downriver from New Orleans, in 1811. It is, in fact, as far as North America goes, in terms of the number of people who come into the field, enslaved people who come into the field, it's the largest slave revolt in North America. And there's nobody's done a whole lot of work on this. I'm actually trying to work on it myself. And there is a significant Haitian component to that revolt. So there's something that's very exciting happening there if you're interested in the history of black revolution in the modern world.
Right. Well, okay. Thank
All right.
you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, to another caller here. This next person is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I believe C.R.R. James in The Black Jacobins does talk about the migration of slaves, but I haven't read the book in a while, but I believe he also suggests that after the Revolution, the island of Hispaniola was a much more desirable place to live than Louisiana, and blacks were actually trying to free Louisiana to move to free Hispaniola.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I have a student, actually, who's been doing wonderful work on free children of color in New Orleans in the 1850s. And she finds that as a school assignment, these free children of color are being asked to write letters to imaginary friends in Haiti. And the way that they write to them is Haiti is the site of black citizenship. It's the site of black political freedom. And so I think that Haiti does turn into a beacon of hope for a lot of people. And I'm glad you mentioned C.L.R. James, because that is, I think, Black Jacobins is one of the greatest history books ever written. And it really is, alongside with my book, which I'm here to plug. So when everybody goes to the bookstore to buy my book, they should get C.L.R. James. So it's a real classic.
Yes, I am. But another question, there was a movement for a withering away of slavery, too, in the 1840s and 50s, which was sort of among the liberal Bourbon aristocrats who wouldn't sell their slaves and tried to get laws passed that would abolish slavery, abolish the sale of slaves to anybody except to the slave themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the failure of that, of course, really fueled the abolitionist movement in the North, and it was the one possibility of trying to have a reform of the South rather than the revolution, which was a civil war. And I just wonder if you know of any works on that subject.
I think the best place to look for things about the history of free people of color and about the history of manumission efforts, which is individuals freeing slaves, and emancipation efforts, which is the state freeing slaves, is Ira Berlin's book, which is called Slaves Without Masters. And that's a book that's written some time ago now. It's written in 1974, but it's a fantastic book about all of those sorts of impulses. There are, you know, that's one, I think, in a line of stories about or of political efforts to find a way to get slavery to sort of disappear without directly engaging the question of emancipation.
I see. You used an expression about the experience of the slaves in New Orleans called from was death or doth. I haven't heard that before. What's the origin of that?
I'm sorry?
You used an expression earlier about that the slaves used in New Orleans, if you were a slave and got sold to New Orleans, it was like...
Oh, right, no.
I haven't heard that one before.
I was responding to the question about suicide.
So
the idea there is that slaves imagine, slaves in a place like Virginia imagine, as I said about Jacob Stroyer, Louisiana is a place of slaughter.
Yes, yes.
So that's why I was saying that there's a comparison that they might make about their possibilities.
Okay, we have a debate over here. Last question.
Okay.
What was the date the last African slave ship landed on the shores of the United States?
Well, it depends on if you count smuggling or not. I think if you count smuggling, it continues to happen probably up through the Civil War.
Yeah, legally.
1808 is when the slave trade is closed.
It was 08. You used that date. And
well, that's part of the United States Constitution. Now, yeah. South Carolina, leading the way... in many things about pro-slavery, reopens the Atlantic slave trade at some point and imports several ships of slaves. So then it would be a question about whether or not you view that as a legal action.
That's it. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, thank you. We're a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580, and I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Walter Johnson. He's Associate Professor of History and American Studies at New York University. He's written a book on this subject. If you're interested, you can look for it. It's titled Soul by Soul, Life Inside the Antebellum Slave Market. It's now available in a paperback edition. It's published by the Harvard University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Another caller here in Crete, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I just wondered, Professor Johnson, the fear of going southwest was great, and perhaps suicide increased among the slaves because of that, and perhaps violence and murder and crime among the slaves increased because of that, and I'd like to see some comments from you on that. But the slave uprisings...
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned 1811. That's probably because of the earthquake. Basically occurred in the East. It occurred
mm-hmm.
in Virginia and Carolina and Vesey and Prosser and Turner. And there was basically nothing except this invisible one in 1811. How do you explain it?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that probably I'm not going to agree immediately with the premise of the question, because I think that there are actually quite a few slave revolts that don't happen on the Eastern Seaboard that haven't become part of the standard narrative of all of the slave revolts. One that I'm very interested in right now is on the slave ship Creole, which happens in 1841, and that's the slave ship which is traveling from Virginia to Louisiana. There's also slave revolt on the National Road. There's a whole series. There's a huge slave revolt convulsion in Mississippi in 1835. I also accept part of the premise of the question, which is that there is something very difficult about organizing a slave revolt in a society that is in a slave community that is being disrupted by the domestic slave trade. All of the slave communities, if you think about a place like Louisiana or Mississippi, are made up of people who don't know one another. And that's the function of the slave trade, is that it takes people from all over the Eastern Seaboard, and that they have to reshape themselves into collectives in a place like Mississippi, so that they may be from North Carolina, some from Virginia. And if you're planning a slave revolt, you have to trust people with your life. It's a very difficult thing to do. I think that the practical political organization of slave revolt is something that historians, aside from C.L.R. James, really, but in a few other examples, haven't thought enough about. And so the way that people come to know one another is very very complicated. So I think it's actually a really interesting, provocative way to try to think about things.
Apicur, I think, listed this.
Right. After, well, that's the place to go for the enumeration of all of these incidents is Herbert Apfecker's American Negro Slave Revolts, which is, I think it's probably published in 1944.
Have you done
quite a classic
survey of which ones occurred east of New Orleans and which occurred west? And
I haven't thought about it that way, and I think that's a very, you know, that I, like I said, I think that's a really interesting way to think about it. Now, like I said, that I think there are plenty of episodes of slave revolts that occur in the West, but to think about migration as one of the real parameters that frame the possibility for slave revolt, I think is a really great idea.
Last question: is there any relationship between that movement to Texas and Louisiana and Arkansas, and increased suicide among the slaves, or increased violence directed against slaves by the master, or increased violence within the slave community based on that migration?
Yeah, all great questions. I think certainly there that I'm not sure how you would measure increased violence in a sense, but there is, without a doubt, the slave trade runs only through the threat and actualization of slaveholders' violence on enslaved people. The slave trade also, I think, like many experiences of domination, can work itself out through violent resistance. And so I think there are plenty of episodes of violent resistance, and you know, the slaveholders wouldn't have so many whips and chains and high walls if they weren't aware of that. So I do think that it becomes a sight, and absolutely a sight for that. Now, whether it's more of a sight for that than what you might call the sphere of production, where people are working and reproducing and all these things, I don't know.
I appreciate the questions of the call. Let's continue. We'll go to another person here, Rantoul, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering if you'd studied anything about the Seminole blacks.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, and then, you know, the fact is that the Seminole, there's a huge Seminole War. This is how Andrew Jackson makes his name as an Indian fighter, is fighting the Seminole. Well, the Seminole are a mixed group of Native Americans and African Americans and Africans. And so that question is, for me, it's not something I've done work on myself, but it's a provocation to thinking about how do you think about a slave revolt? And many of the biggest slave revolts have been misnamed as other things, i.e. the Seminole War, which is thought to be an Indian war, but you could equally think about it as a slave revolt. You could think about the American Revolution as one of the greatest slave revolts in history, that there are, you know, 20,000 slaves who participate both through running away and actually fighting in the American Revolution. Same with the Civil War. There are 200,000 formerly enslaved people who fight for the Union Army. Now, people don't want to call those things slave revolts because they don't look like Nat Turner looks. And while I think it's important not to say that the Civil War is the same thing as Nat Turner, it is important to me to think about enslaved people joining in military conflict as bringing an element of slave revolt into these existing conflicts. Almost every war in American history involves the Americans joining an existing conflict. So if you're going to think about World War II as an American war, it makes sense in some way to think about the Civil War as partially a slave revolt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just here just recently I've read a little bit about that, and I didn't realize that the Seminole Wars were so much about the Indians were trying to protect their land, but the blacks were trying to stay free.
Absolutely. It's Florida in particular, like Louisiana at the end of the 18th century, is a fascinating place because you have maroon communities, which are communities of runaway slaves who established societies, independent societies hidden from white domination, and that does feed into the Seminole Wars in a really serious way. It's very interesting stuff.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank
you. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that slaves certainly could be and were sold locally or regionally. If an individual, an owner, wanted to sell a slave, they could ask their neighbors. There were brokers that would broker transactions locally, but there also were slave traders that would travel around. They would put up posters saying that they were interested. They were available to buy and so forth. And then groups of slaves were put together and transported as a group to New Orleans, where they came to the markets and then were housed, jailed, kept in groups when they were sold. And what's interesting here is that here we have individuals who certainly have the experience of slavery in common, but they don't know each other. They could be from different places here coming together. And you write about the fact that within to the extent that they could in these traveling groups, and then when they got to New Orleans, there was a kind of community formed among these individuals.
That's absolutely right, and it's something that comes through the slave narratives very clearly, is that as they write their own stories, the slave narrators often introduce other characters, and they introduce other characters with full biographies. And those biographies are a trace of the conversations that people have in the slave trade, of that they tell their lives to one another. And that, for me, is a trace of their building a network of trust and support. That can be simply something that helps them survive what is a terrifying and brutal experience. In some cases, those networks of trust and support actually turn resistant, and in the revolutionary sense, they become the site of slave revolts. And it is, I think, it's a very interesting story of how people in a situation of the greatest exigency build a community. That process continues in the new enslaved communities of a place like Louisiana, where people are born all over the place, all over the eastern seaboard or the Midwest, like Missouri or wherever, and get to know one another and form a community, a slave community in Louisiana.
What was it like there in Louisiana? And if one went down, and I understand that this, I hesitate to use the term tourist attraction, but apparently people actually did go just to look when they went to New Orleans. If you went there, what would it be like? What would you see?
Well, I mean, it is, you know, just the image is interesting, because one of the ways that people go to see slavery is they go to see the slave market in New Orleans. And there are really two ways that slaves are sold in New Orleans. One is auction. Those auctions are generally state-ordered sales. So those are the estate sales or the debt sales. And they occur in the city's fancy hotels. They occur beneath this huge rotunda in the St. Charles Hotel. And people line up and they serve free lunches. The free lunches are in some sense an indication of the spectacular character of the undertaking. The sales that I'm talking about, the slave trader sales, occur in two different neighborhoods of the city. And they occur in fairly standard retail buildings, except for the fact that all these retail buildings have high walls. And sometimes the slaves are lined up on the street in front. They are dressed up. They are dressed up in suits, top hats, dresses, head coverings, and for display. And so that's what the travelers see. Now, some of the travelers, both in a kind of a prurient way and in a in an activist, critical way, try to go further into the slave market, and they try to talk to the slaves and to see how their bodies are inspected, which is, the inspections are very minute, and so that's the sort of access, that's the access that northern readers have to the slave market.
Yeah. And I'm sure in the popular imagination that people think about the idea of a slave sale, they probably do think about an auction. They have this picture in their mind of the person standing up on the block and having an open outcry. And as you say, that did happen, but that perhaps more common was a different kind of sale, a more quiet sort of negotiation perhaps, and that the slaves, those people who were being sold, tried to do things as much as they could to affect the circumstances of the sale, who they would be sold to, what they would be sold to do.
Absolutely right. I mean, the auction is, that's the image that people have of the slave trade, and it's a very powerful and useful image. The interstate slave trade, the slave trade in the proper sense of slave traders selling slaves to people, does occur in the lower South in terms of these private bargains, which can go on for days, and which involve bodily inspections, which involve the buyers asking the slaves a lot of questions, and in fact which necessarily involve the slaves in the middle of the transaction. Nobody in the antebellum South would trust a slave trader. Slave traders are notoriously dishonest. They notoriously lie about the health, the age, the origin, the history, everything about the slaves who they sell. So the slave buyers can only get information by information that they think they might trust by asking the slaves questions. What that does is it involves the slaves right in the middle of the process. And you find, if you look in slave narratives, you find incredible statements. You find John Parker saying, "I made up my mind to choose my own master." And so Parker is sitting there in the slave market evaluating the slaveholders in the same way that they are evaluating him. Now, the thing about the slaveholders is that they're not all dressed in identical clothes, in identical black suits with top hats. That they are dressed in ways that reveal all kinds of things about them. And they ask questions that reveal more things about them, that reveal what type of work they're interested in having the slave do, that reveal whether or not they're willing to buy the enslaved person with their family members. An endless number of those questions. And so enslaved people can gather a lot of information as the process goes on. And they do shape their own sales sometimes. Sometimes they undermine sales to buyers who they don't want to be sold to. And this drives slave traders crazy.
Would one rather be bought by... one thing I'm sure you could tell about a person was how wealthy they were.
Right.
Perhaps also how well-spoken, how well-educated, and so forth. Would one rather be sold to a wealthy person?
Well, it's interesting that I think that there's sort of an assumption that would be the case. It's not one of the reasons that I've seen. The reasons, the distinctions that I've seen are between the country and the city. Mm-hmm. A lot of people want to be sold in the city. Many people have family in the city. Many people think that it's easier to escape from the city. Because, you know, if you're in New Orleans, well, there's steamboats leaving New Orleans every single minute of the day, really. And so there's a real possibility of escape there. There's a set of distinctions about what type of work you'll have to do. But the biggest one is to be sold with family members. I think that's the one that surfaces again and again.
What I think that it is easy to see the slave in this whole process as completely passive, and an individual that the whole process is acted upon and that has no power to do any acting themselves. And I think that's something that you really try to address in your work and say, well, that's really not the case. Having said that, I'm interested. It's very clear the effect that this relationship between the owner and the slave had on the slave. What sort of things can one say about what this relationship meant, what sort of effect there was upon the owner?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that there's been a lot of energy of sociological, historical, pop psychological energy devoted to thinking about the psychology of enslavement. There's been considerably less energy devoted to thinking about the psychology of enslaving. And I argue in the book that it's a very destabilizing relationship. Slaveholders go to the slave market to reshape themselves in some way. If you think about all of the things that we think about when we think about the antebellum South, all of the fine dinner parties, all of the shiny cufflinks, all of the well-tended fields, all of the white children raised by black caretakers. All of those things are performed through the direct agency of slaves. So in some sense, slaveholders' social identities are made by their slaves. And so what happens is when slaveholders go to the slave market and buy a slave, they often talk about how this is going to change their life. And that's what occurs again and again in these letters I've read. They're often disappointed. In fact, I would say that they are almost necessarily disappointed, that their fantasy can never be identical, that the person they buy can never be identical to their fantasy. And so it's one of my arguments that that's part of the reason that you see this extraordinary brutality that you see surrounding slavery, is slaveholders' inability to have their fantasies realized by the people they buy to do it for them.
I think it's interesting that included in the book here in the section where there are illustrations and photographs is a portrait of an obviously wealthy Southern couple. This is Colonel and Mrs. James Whiteside. It's a painting of them posed. They're sitting there. They're very well dressed, and the backdrop is the landscape, which undoubtedly we're to assume is theirs. But also interestingly, in this picture are two slaves. There's a baby that's their son, but there are two servants. Looks like a boy and a woman who's holding the baby on her lap. And I think it's interesting that here in their official portrait, in their family picture, they should not only show themselves and their child, but two slaves.
No, it is. It's quite striking. And it's actually a fairly common style of portraiture. And it is. That makes the point in a very, I think, striking way, is that when they sit down to have themselves represented, to have the picture made that represents who these people are, they include their slaves. And so that is an index, I think, of that type of identity dependency that explodes so often into violence when the slaves in the picture don't behave, don't pose the way that they're supposed to.
Just to finish, are there some ways in which you think scholarship of this period of American history and of slavery in America in relatively recent times has changed our fundamental understanding of this institution? I know that's an awfully big question.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a more of an emphasis on, and this for me is a very salutary emphasis, on the daily way that enslaved people live their lives and resisted slavery. And that comes out of an effort, I think, to see the institution from their perspective. And that I think, has been, you know, it's not in some sense brand new. There's been a lot of people who've been doing fantastic work on this for a long time. But it is, I think, very, very vital. Vital both in the sense of its importance, but vital in that it's very alive. And so, for me, that's been a conversation that's very exciting and one that I really tried to contribute my little two cents to.
Well, I want to say to you very much thanks for spending some time and talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great.
Our guest, Walter Johnson. He is Associate Professor of History and American Studies at New York University. His book, if you would like to read it, is titled Soul by Soul, Life Inside the Antebellum Slave Market. It's now available in a paperback edition. It's published by the Harvard University Press.